Well, today I want to bring you all into the classroom. And by that I mean I have a lesson for us. Lessons are important. You know, we learn countless lessons in life. Some are obvious and we recognize them immediately. Others are not so obvious and we need a bit of a nudge. I've discovered that having children is a great lesson in humility because it's been used to remind me that I'm not the center of the universe and I can't just go through my life doing what I simply want to do. The lesson from God is that I'm more selfish than I realize and I need to change. You see, lessons are critical for human development. And in our passage this morning, we have a very simple lesson, but a critical lesson for living the Christian life. I am going to say that it's more useful than any other lesson in our following after Jesus. And it's a lesson we can find anywhere in the Bible, but today we'll be taught this lesson by a deceptive rascal, because this man is Jacob. And he's a man who's renamed Israel. The name change means that Jacob's the head of the new family, the new people of God. And so this is a key lesson today, and it's a key lesson about the way that God works. And here it is. This is for Catherine on your baptism day, but for all of us, we are to cling to God. God will work to order all events to ensure that we cling to Him. And so the path to victory in the Christian life will seem to us to be defeat. We're to cling to God in human weakness. And if we don't learn that lesson, then we won't make sense of the Christian life. We'll lack joy, and we won't understand events as they unfold. So where are we up to? Well, Jacob's fled the promised land. His brother wants to kill him. And 20 years has passed. Jacob's been in the grip of his uncle Laban. He has four wives under his wing. And he is the father of the, so far, 11 tribes of Israel. And all along the way, we've been hearing God's voice, haven't we? God has been saying to Jacob over and again, look, Jacob, you can't do anything. You can't achieve my plans. You need to wait, to sit back, to rest, and stop striving. And that's because Jacob's been pretty rubbish at that. He's been cheating, working and striving to bring about the purposes of God. But now he's finally beginning to realize that salvation doesn't happen that way. You don't climb the ladder of spiritual success. If salvation's attained, it must be all of God and none of us. He's beginning to get it, and now he's about to come home. See, this is a homecoming story. But the nagging thought in the back of our minds is, well, how will Esau react when he sets his gaze on his brother? Is it all over, Red Rover? Or has the bridge begun to heal? Well, one thing's for certain, Jacob's attitude is different than when he left. He's coming back with a deeper humility, but he also comes back with a misplaced fear. And before we dive in, I just want to make one comment about how this passage is often preached. It goes something like this. You know, Jacob wrestled with God and got the blessing. And so what we need to do is wrestle with God in prayer and we'll receive a blessing. I think that's how it's often preached. But is that what's going on? Well, I want you to hold that thought for now. And we have two short but sweet points this morning: facing your enemies and wrestling with God. And so let's begin with the first point: facing your enemies. Jacob goes on his way, verse 1, and we're told that he stumbles upon an angel encampment, which, by the way, is meant to be an echo of the Garden of Eden. So the promised land in Israel is Eden 2.0, which is why Jacob meets angels when he leaves Canaan and when he returns. Remember the angel guarding the Garden of Eden with the sword. But that's kind of a side point. But as Jacob treks home, he realizes the burning issue, doesn't he? He's thinking, yes. My brother, the last time I heard from him, he wanted to put me in the grave. And so verse 3, we're told Jacob sent messengers before him to Esau, his brother, in the land of Seir, the country of Edom, instructing them, saying, look, this is what you're to say to my lord Esau. Thus says Jacob, I've sojourned with Laban and stayed until now. I have oxen, donkeys, flocks, male servants and female servants. I've sent to tell my lord in order that I may find favor in your sight. Right? And so Jacob sends a message to his brother. If he's living today, he'd probably use WhatsApp. Notice that the Lord's servant stuff. Did you notice that? Is Jacob buttering him up? Well, probably. And then he mentions how minted he is, doesn't he? And he's not doing that to show off, but to hint to Esau that, look, he's able to pay Esau if needs be. He's essentially saying, look, 20 years have passed. I've got more possessions that you can even dare to imagine. I can give you anything you need. Ask me and it's yours. But before we can even begin to reflect on Jacob's words, our worst fears have come true. Look at verse 6. The messengers returned to Jacob saying, we came to your brother Esau, and he's coming to meet you, and there are 400 men with him. In the Bible, 400 men is the size of a small militia. And so this is really bad news. And so verse 7, then Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed, and he divided the people who were with him and the flocks into two camps, thinking, look, if Esau comes to one of them, one of the camps and attacks it, then the camp that is left will escape. And so Jacob's petrified, and rightly so. For us to begin to feel why, let me just remind us of what's happened. Jacob has stolen the blessing from his brother. That's the modern equivalent of a younger brother taking advantage of his older brother's absence to commit identity theft in order to steal the right to run the family farm, to own all of the tractors and implements, to manage the cattle, to hire and fire all the workers, and to inherit the family bank account with no legal penalty and no way to undo the theft. Of course Esau wants to bludgeon Jacob. I have a sneaking suspicion that most of us would be murderously angry if we were in a similar situation. But there's no wonder that Jacob fears for his life. Think about what he's done, and now a small militia is on the way. You know, this is war. War is on the horizon. So what do you do in a moment like that? What does Jacob do? Well, he doesn't put on his greaves. He drops to his knees and he prays a prayer. I notice that Jacob doesn't pray, Lord, thank you that I'm worthy of your grace. And he doesn't pray that he's brilliant. Instead, he recounts God's faithfulness. Verse 9. He prays, O God of my father Abraham and of Isaac, O Lord, who said to me, return to your country and to your kindred that I may do you good. I'm not worthy of the least of the deeds of steadfast love and all the faithfulness that you've shown to your servant. For with only my staff I crossed the Jordan, and now I've become two camps. Please deliver me from the hand of my brother Esau, for I fear him, that he may come and attack me, the mothers with the children. But you said, I will surely do you good, and make your offspring as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered. What do you make of this prayer? I think on the surface it looks good, doesn't it? I wonder how you'd score it. Maybe a B+. He addresses the Lord as the God of Abraham. That's a big win. That's a tick. He recounts God's faithfulness to him and promises. Yep, another tick. He admits his own unworthiness. Yep, that's good. And then he asks for God's help. Tick. But if we scratch beneath the surface, we find the all-too-predictable Jacob manipulating the facts again. This is what the commentator said, and I'm pretty convinced of it. The first blemish is pretty funny. While describing God's faithfulness, Jacob notes that he left home with a staff and has now become two camps. Wow. How did he become two camps? Well, right before the prayer, Jacob took things into his own hands and divided his people into two camps. And the purpose of the camps was to minimize his losses. It would be kind of like me taking £20,000, dividing it between two saving accounts, and then kneeling before the Lord and praying, Lord, I once only had a few quid to my name, but now I have two bank accounts thanks to you. One commentator said, Jacob camouflages his own scheming as evidence of God's blessing. Second, much more serious, Jacob actually misquotes God's word back to him, which is never a good thing in Scripture. Two times in the prayer, Jacob quotes God as saying, I will do you good, or I will surely do you good. But here's the thing, God never uttered those words. What did God actually say? Well, at Bethel and while in exile, God said, I am with you and I'll be with you. In other words, God promises his presence. He never promised anything about the abundance of material goods and the saving of these camps. God never promised any of that. So what are we seeing? Well, Jacob at work again, seeking to manipulate the situation for his own benefit. If we're charitable, we could say that Jacob's simply expanding on God's promises. If we're charitable, maybe you could say that. But given what we know about the heel side of Jacob, he seems to be employing his bargaining skills on heaven itself. And what's mind-blowing is that Jacob gets what he asks for, and even more than he asks for. Look at verse 11. Jacob begs, doesn't he? Please, Lord, deliver me from the hand of Esau. God goes way further than that. He arranges a family reunion with embrace, kisses, and tears of joy. Once again, the scoundrel Jacob gets what he doesn't deserve, which has been the constant theme of this part of Genesis. Before we move into Jacob's famous encounter, because I do want us to get there pretty soon, I want you to glance over verses 13 to 21, because what we see here is Jacob sends presents to Esau. In other words, he plans, prays for the best, and prepares for the worst. But what's interesting about this section, actually, is all the sacrificial language. It's language that you find of the temple. Most of these animals are used in the offering. And look at verse 20. We read, Jacob thinks that I may appease Esau. The word appease is actually the word to atone. Atonement is a salvation word. Jacob wants to propitiate the wrath of his brother, which means that he's fearing for his life, rightly so, as he comes back into God's new Eden. And this is going to be a great lesson for Israel too, as they face their own enemies. Remember that Moses is writing Genesis right before the people of God enter the land of promise. Are you going to be afraid of those terrifying giants? Will you let yourself be mastered by fear? Or are you going to trust in the God who promises to be with you all the way? Will you cling to God even when life doesn't make sense? That's the question that Jacob's facing. It's the question that Israel are facing as they read Genesis. And it's the question that the church faces in the 21st century, isn't it? Will you and I cling to God when life doesn't make sense? Will we trust God in our illness, in our depression, in our darkest moments? What about when life throws a curveball? Or what about when the reality of the Christian warfare intensifies and feels way more real? When it feels just like the gates of hell are up against you at the moment? What then? Well, for some of us, it feels particularly real right now. As Christians, we go to war against the world, the flesh, and the devil. And at times, it can feel pretty scary, pretty futile, and sometimes hopeless. How will someone like me stand in the fiery trial? If persecution begins to come with greater intensity than it is, will I be able to press on? How will I press on? Well, what did Jesus say? What would Jesus say to Jacob? I think it would go something like this. Do not fear those who can kill the body. Fear the one who, after killing the body, can throw the soul into hell. See, the antidote to the fear of man is the fear of God. That is the medicine that Jacob needs to drink. The fear of God. Awe of God. It's the medicine that Israel need to drink before they step into the land. And friends, it is the medicine that we need to drink. As fearing our Maker and Redeemer. Jacob seems to lack the fear of God, and that's exposed by his fear of Esau. He gets things kind of right, doesn't he? But he gets it wrong too. And I guess one of the questions we might be asking at this stage is, will God let us go on with compromised lives? Jacob's all too predictable, isn't he? He prays for the best and plans for the worst. He fudges the facts. He tries to take things into his own hands. Jacob's a compromised worshiper just like us. How long will God leave us in that kind of state? Well, he can just keep doing it He can just work in spite of us forever. But will there ever be transformation? Will Jacob's best prayers always fudge the facts and get it wrong? What will God do with Jacob, and what will God do with us? Well, how about we find out? Point number two, wrestling with God. The payback's coming. Death awaits. Jacob scrambling to put things right. We're feeling a bit hot in the room. Esau and a bunch of bloodthirsty men are a scary sight for sore eyes. And so there's this wave of tension in the passage. Jacob's coming home, but Esau's coming to meet him with a small army. Jacob wants to avert his wrath, but who knows if it's going to work. And so verse 22, Jacob arose, took his two wives, his servants, and his 11 children, and crossed the ford of the Jabbok. He took them and sent them across the stream and everything else that he had. And we're told Jacob was left alone. Oh, whoops. So what's going on? Well, again, Jacob's planning for the worst. He comes up with a plan to avoid a bloodbath. Jacob sends his family away because he's afraid of being attacked. And so on the darkest night of his life, Jacob sits alone in the silence, reflecting on the past and what the sunlight may bring. And you can imagine, can't you? He's overcome with fear. And then we get this in verse 24. Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until the breaking of the day. And so the narrative has been setting us up to expect a war between the two parties. You know, we're sat here thinking, well, we're about to watch a bloodbath. And so imagine how Jacob feels right now as he senses a bump and a grab. His worst nightmare's coming true. Esau's found me. This is the moment. And I get, as the readers of the story, we get it. It's a supernatural showdown with the Lord. But remember, Jacob doesn't know that yet. He thinks it's Esau. He must be thinking it's Esau. Well, we get a clue in verse 26. I won't let you go unless you bless me. What does that sound like? Given what we know of what we've already read in Jacob's life. Well, chapter 25, when he snatches the birthright. Well, chapter 27, when he steals the blessing. I have a sneaking suspicion that Jacob thinks the man is Esau, and he thinks that he needs to wrestle the blessing out of him. There's a whole chunk of ambiguity. Three verses later, he still doesn't know who it is because he says, please tell me your name. And so Jacob wrestles with what he thinks is Esau. Jacob has a really good knack of wrestling with others, doesn't he? That the heel grabber is doing what he does best. And so the man gives the divine touch. Verse 25. When the man realized he did not prevail against Jacob, he touched his hip socket, and Jacob's hip was put out of joint as he wrestled with him. He then gets a new name. We'll come to that in a moment. And then we're told in verse 28 that Jacob wrestled with God and prevailed. And later on, I saw God face to face, which is all the knowledge we need to identify this mysterious man. It's God. And by God, we must mean God the Son. Why do I say God the Son? Well, because of John 1:18. No one has ever seen God the Father. So it can't be God the Father. But God the Son has made him known. So this is Jacob wrestling with a pre-incarnate Jesus. And what's amazing is Jacob prevails. Jacob prevails. And we're going to be asking how. How has Jacob prevailed? How has Jacob gone 12 rounds in the ring with God and come out the other side victorious? Well, in the same way that my three-year-old daughter wrestles me and wins. At times we'll sit on the floor and play tug-of-war with one of her teddies, and she wins every time. You could say she prevails against Dad. Well, that's obviously only because I let her win. And so what are we seeing? We're seeing, it's just amazing, God the Son slips into a human frame for an overnight stay at the Jabbok. And with biceps, hands and feet, he mingles his breath and sweat with the patriarch of God's people. Though he's God, he empties himself by taking the form of a human wrestler, manifests himself in the likeness of men, and being found in human form, he humbles himself by refusing to win the fight, even the fight with Jacob. The Son, being divine and all-powerful, limits his strength so Jacob might win. Isn't that amazing? Isn't that so much better than what we usually hear? We need to wrestle with God, beat him, and get a blessing? No. God's allowing himself to be defeated. And he allows Jacob's life to be delivered. You see, God has come down in weakness, not strength. A redemption is achieved in the way that we wouldn't expect. Jacob realizes that he's the three-year-old fighting the dad. But he's prevailed because God has delivered him. Look at verse 30. He doesn't boast about his victory. Verse 30, he instead confesses, I have seen God face to face, and yet my life has been delivered. That's how Jacob understands this whole event. This is what it's about. It's not about praying and wrestling with God in prayer. His life has been delivered and spared. And so at the end of the day, the amazing thing isn't that Jacob's so strong he can go 12 rounds with God. What's amazing is that God allows himself to be defeated. This is the story of God's weakness and condescending grace. In fact, St. Augustine says that this account prefigures the cross. This is what Augustine said 1,500 years earlier. He said, as he wrestled, Jacob prevailed. Christ was prefiguring his future actions. It was by his own will that he laid down his strength with Jacob, just as he lays down his life and takes it up again. So I wonder if you have eyes to see what's going on this morning. As we watch the two wrestlers in the dark, as we hear their grunts and spy their strain, we're witnessing a portrayal of the final climactic fight between God and man on the blood-soaked soil beneath a Roman cross in a darkened land. Through Jacob's wrestling match, we're gazing at the scene of Calvary, aren't we? There, the descendants of Jacob will lay their hands on the Son of God, who emptied himself, took on the form of human nature, and humbled himself to the cross. He whom Jacob pinned to the ground will one day be nailed to a tree. And the Son of God, embracing his deadly defeat, will proclaim victory over death by saying, it is finished. It is done. God has lost. We have won. But that doesn't tell the whole story, does it? Because the cross was planned before the very foundation of the world. And so what seems like God's defeat is actually God's victory. The cross of Jesus wasn't a regrettable wrong that required the divine GPS to recalibrate the journey of salvation. No, the cross was the destination all along. And his defeat has become our victory. Down into the dirt, Jesus went. Up onto the cross, Jesus went. And from him we receive everlasting life. And along with Jacob, we can declare, with Jacob today, my life has been delivered. My life has been delivered. I wonder if you can join Jacob in that profession of faith today as you're here. As we sit here in the presence of God, can you say, my life has been delivered? If you can't say that, let me encourage you to let Jesus in. See, wrestling with God by your own good works is futile. You need to be perfect to do that. Now, what you need to do today is to accept Christ's defeat on the cross, because that defeat was actually God's stunning victory. Through the cross alone, you can declare, my life has been delivered. So receive his victory today. All you need to do is call upon him. Receive it. Don't leave this morning without having met God at the cross. What does this have to do with baptism? Absolutely everything. Because baptism is a beautiful picture of the weakness of God, where God works in ways we just wouldn't expect. See, Catherine will identify herself with Jesus through water in his death, burial, and resurrection. How does baptism signal Catherine's rescue? Well, because Jesus laid down his life in weakness in order to raise her up in glory. And in baptism, we're washed in a new name, aren't we? That's what Jesus says in Matthew 28. Baptize them into the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit. We have a new identity and a new family and a new name. And so let's for a moment just turn to Jacob's new name. I really love God's question in verse 27. Don't you just love that? How God pursues man all the way through the Bible. God knows the answer to this question, but look at what he says. What is your name? What is your name? Remember that names are critical for identity. God echoes the question that Isaac asked all those chapters ago. And remember in that moment when Isaac asked that question, what did Jacob say? I'm Esau. And so God's basically saying, come clean. Who are you? Who are you really? And he said, Jacob. Then God said, well, you shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel. For you have striven with God and with man and have prevailed. See, with a new name comes a new identity. With a new name, it becomes impossible to tell your story without telling God's story. What do I mean by that? Well, as Abraham was renamed Abraham, he was constantly reminded of the promise that God will make him into the father of many nations. And as Jacob becomes Israel, he'll be forever reminded that God has met him in divine grace. Because people will be coming up to him, hey, I thought you were called Jacob. Well, yeah, I was, and then this happened, this hip thing. And so this is a life-altering moment. The story of God and the story of Jacob are now woven together, which will eventually climax in the redeemed people of the Messiah. Right, do you get how important that is? But the name change also comes with something else, something not so pleasant. Jacob walks away newly named, but also newly wounded. And so it's not just that Jacob prevails over God. God wounds Jacob. Remember during the skirmish, God the Son touches the hip and it sort of pops out. Which is why, look at verse 31. When it's all over, we read, the sun rose upon him as he passed Peniel, limping because of his hip. Therefore, to this day, the people of Israel do not eat the sinew of the thigh that's on the hip socket, because he, that's God, touched the socket of Jacob's hip on the sinew of the thigh. And so the descendants of Jacob, they keep this memory alive. Yet we don't eat that part of the animal, a dad would tell his son. Why? Well, let me tell you the story. And he would tell the story when God fought with man, when God lost and man prevailed, and the winner limped away with a wound that tells an unforgettable story. And so God will ensure that we are weak and that we cling to him. I wonder if Jacob ever recovered from his MMA fight with the Lord. My guess is he didn't. And anyone that tells you that becoming a follower of Jesus equals an easy and comfortable life is a charlatan. And now that doesn't mean that our lives are dismal and sour. Rather, it means that we'll limp day by day with the secret joy of the divinely scarred. What will that look like? Well, it will look different for all of us. And it will come in different waves on the pilgrimage. And each limp and scar reminds us each day that we live every moment by the grace of God. See, if the Lord removed his mercy for a moment, we'd be helpless and hopeless. The life of following Jesus isn't about us getting stronger. No, it's about us becoming increasingly aware of our weakness and the Lord's strength. Emptied of ourselves, we're filled with Jesus. See, the people that become a blessing are those who are weak and frail. Jacob will learn this lesson, and it's a Bible lesson, isn't it? Gideon, my clan is the smallest. I'm the weakest. Samson, David, Gethsemane. as one man in utter weakness kneels and clings to God in prayer before the moment of his execution, through which he becomes the blessing to the nations. As we cling to the God of grace, God will bring us to the point where we recognize our weakness. Supremely, we learn this lesson in age and death. See, if you fast forward, hit the fast forward button to your own death, for some of us it's probably going to be longer than others to get there than others. What do you see? Well, there you will be utterly weak. And as you cling to the God of promise, who has shown you in the weakness of Jesus that the path to victory is through weakness, there as you cling to God in death, God will demonstrate himself to be triumphantly powerful. As you lie on your deathbed, you don't want someone coming up to you saying, "How good have you been as a Christian?" You want someone to come alongside and say, "Jesus has got you. Yes, you're weak, of course you are. But he is strong. He loves you. He will carry you home." At the beginning of the sermon, I said the lesson today is the most important lesson we can learn in Christianity. I wonder if you agree. God will give us a limp, that we might cling to his promise in weakness. See, Catherine, this is a lesson that you're going to desperately need to remember. If you want to understand all the ups and downs of your life, you need to remember this day of your baptism. God will make you weak to make you strong. And when we don't learn this, we'll fail to be content. Because when something bad happens, we'll think it's a terrible mistake. You know, if we take this lesson on, then wherever we are, God will work in his sovereignty to ensure that we cling to him. And if we don't recognize this now, then we will realize it in our death, because there we will be in weakness. And the glory of the gospel is that through the weakness of Jesus, through his death for your sins, as you cling to him desperately, he will bring you victory. Many of you know this, but just before I became a believer, I was addicted to the gym. My life centered on bodybuilding. But a few months before I became a Christian, a few months before that moment, my back gave way as I was doing deadlifts. And I was unable to really lift weights properly and all but ending any chance of a bodybuilding career. And I bear the scar of that day. That's my limp. And my back has never recovered. But from hindsight, God used that moment to bring an end to myself, to end my own self-delusion of strength, and to embrace my weakness and my need for him. See, for you it will be a different story, different limps that you have to walk with, different beginnings and different ends, but it will be the same story, which is the story of grace. The story of God the Son wounding us to make us whole, dying for us to give us life, and saving us to bring us hope.